Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. This is As It Is, a radio program and podcast that helps you learn and improve your American English. We come to you every day with interesting and important stories from around the world. If English is not your first language, we make these stories easy to understand by presenting them slowly. We also use words and sentences that are easy to understand. We recommend that you save the program on your computer and listen to it often. Start slowly, saying the words the way we do. Soon you will be speaking English the American way. Today we have two stories for you. The first one is about illegal food in Russia and what is being done with it. Then more about ongoing problems between Palestinians and Israelis. This time we focus on passports and identification papers. So, if you are ready, let's get started with part one. The government in Russia is moving forward with efforts to destroy food imports from Western countries. The government banned the imports because of the dispute between Russia and the West over Ukraine. But a growing number of Russians say they find the ban in bad taste. That is the sound of heavy, earth-moving equipment running over Western cheese. Other Russian workers are burning boxes of frozen bacon, and state media reporters are cheering on the process. All this comes after President Vladimir Putin signed an order to destroy all Western foods that enter Russia in violation of existing sanctions. Government officials say 350 tons of banned foods have been destroyed since the program went into effect earlier this month. There are plans to destroy even more. Russia's agriculture ministry has even requested a traveling food crematoria to speed up the work. Those machines would turn the food into ashes. Such moves have led some to make fun of the program, and to a fair share of jokes among Russians on social media. But still others are criticizing the government's decision as insensitive. They say several generations of Russians can remember periods of hunger and food shortages. In St. Petersburg last week, Karina Hestinova joined a group of demonstrators protesting the food destruction law. She and others noted that many older adults in what was then the city of Leningrad starved to death during World War II. To this day, she says, no one throws away food on the table. It's offensive what they're doing, she adds. An online campaign calling on government officials to overturn the decision has already gained over 300,000 supporters. When reached by Skype, the organizer, Olga Savilyeva, says she is asking for banned goods to be donated to those in need. Payments to retired workers are small, and prices have gone up, even on food made here in Russia, she says. President Putin's spokesman said the government may be open to some compromise. While the food destruction program will continue for now, the government plans to discuss Ms. Savilyeva's campaign when it meets this week. You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Most Palestinians living in East Jerusalem want the area to become the capital of a future Palestinian state. So, for many years, Palestinians there have rejected the idea of becoming Israeli citizens. But that situation is changing. Today, more and more Palestinians are seeking Israeli citizenship. Many say they do it because they feel they must. The Reuters News Service spoke with one Palestinian teacher who asked not to be identified. She said, "I have a bad feeling because I would like to have the passport of my country as a Jerusalemite, as a Palestinian, so I should have a Palestinian passport. But unfortunately, I cannot get one. Instead, I got something that will only connect me more to Jerusalem." Some Palestinians say that full citizenship will help them get better jobs and other benefits. Others disagree, like Gassan Nofal of East Jerusalem. He said, "For someone who has children, a house, a business, and all these things, the citizenship could never help. If they give us a passport and take away our IDs, it is the same for me." It is not all about benefits. The homes of some Palestinians have been separated from the rest of Jerusalem for the past 10 years. Israel built a wall around them after a number of suicide bombings. Those Palestinians fear they may lose Jerusalem residency as a result. Israel's Interior Ministry keeps records of Palestinian passport applications. Reuters says there were 434 passport requests for the year 2012-2013. Israeli officials approved 189 of them. The news agency said most of the rest are still being processed. Amnon Ramon is a researcher at the Jerusalem Institute for Israel Studies. He said, "We are indeed witnessing an increase in the number of East Jerusalemites who have permanent residency status in the State of Israel who are seeking Israeli citizenship. The question of how big this increase is debatable." Palestinian officials pushing for a state that would include East Jerusalem are concerned. Khalil Tufakci is a former member of the Palestinian negotiating team. He said, "There is a big risk that if the situation continues, what will the Palestinians negotiate about? They want to negotiate about land. They already lost the land. They want to negotiate for the population, and the population is being lost." The demographic effect could be even wider, they argue, when the children of those become Israeli. Those boys and girls will be born Israeli citizens. Officials in Jerusalem deny that the demographics will affect Israel's negotiations with Palestinians. This is VOA, the Voice of America. We are coming to you from Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. Experts say ground-based radar is unable to track about 75% of aircraft flights. But that has continued to be the usual method since the 1940s. This is one reason the Malaysia Airways Flight 370 plane has not been found. Now, there are plans to deploy aircraft tracking satellites into space so that no plane will ever be lost again. The satellite communications company Iridium plans to have 66 satellites orbiting the planet. They call the system of satellites the Next Constellation. Iridium will begin the project in December. The Next satellites will be able to receive an airplane's location signal every few seconds. MH370 flew out of the range of Malaysian military radar while over the Indian Ocean early last year. The plane has yet to be found. Don Toma is the CEO of the aircraft tracking company Aireon. He says MH370 showed the limits of the current tracking system.
It highlighted to the rest of the world and to the public at large what the aviation industry already knew, that over 70% of the world doesn't have surveillance. Aircraft aren't tracked flying over a major, major portion of the world.
The satellite's receivers update every few seconds. They receive information from equipment in the pilot area of the aircraft. Iridium monitors the satellites from a control center in Virginia. Aircraft safety rules require large distances between planes since they cannot currently be tracked over entire oceans. But once the next satellites are set up in 3 years, planes will be able to fly closer to each other. Airlines will then be able to save money on fuel. Passengers will see more flights and more direct flights to locations around the world. The company is also building an emergency operations center 10 kilometers north of Shannon Airport in Ireland. If an aircraft is lost, the airline or rescue organization could contact the center for the plane's last flight track. Tony Merrigan is with the Irish Aviation Authority.
That's unique now because it'd be within 8 seconds or so of when the last contact was made, which is a huge, the distance would be narrowed down in the case of MH370 if that was available at the time.
And that's the VOA Learning English Environment and Science Report. For more environment and science programs, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Keep listening for our program on American history, The Making of a Nation. I'm Jonathan Evans.
VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we continue the story of the United States Constitution. In May of 1787, a group of America's early leaders met in the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They planned to amend the Articles of Confederation.
That document established a loose union of the 13 states. Instead, they wrote a completely new constitution. It created America's system of government and recognized the rights of its citizens. Last week, we talked about the debate at the convention over the Virginia Plan. The plan was prepared by James Madison and other delegates from the state of Virginia. It described a national government with a supreme legislature, executive, and judiciary. Some delegates feared that such a central government would take away power from the states, but in the end, they approved the proposal. On June 1st, they began debate on the issue of a national executive. It seemed every delegate at the Philadelphia Convention had something to say about the issue. They had been thinking about it for some time. Almost every delegate was afraid to give the position extended powers. Almost no one wanted America's chief executive to become as powerful as a king. Still, many of the delegates had faith in the idea of a one-person executive. Others demanded an executive of three people. James Wilson of Pennsylvania argued for a single executive. He said the position required energy and the ability to make decisions quickly. He said these would best be found in one person. Edmund Randolph of Virginia disagreed strongly. He said he considered a one-person executive as the fetus of monarchy. John Dickinson of Delaware said he did not denounce the idea of having a government headed by a king. He said a monarchy was one of the best forms of government in the world. However, in America, he said, a king was out of the question. The debate over the size of the executive leadership lasted a long time. Finally, the delegates voted for a one-person executive. The question of how to limit power was a major part of the delegates' conversation, according to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas.
We're still talking about what are the limits of the national government? What is the role of the national government? How do we protect individual rights and individual liberties, etc.?
And he says that question continues to be asked in America today. During the debate at the convention, other questions about the national executive arose. One question was the executive's term. Should the executive serve just once, or could that person be re-elected? Alexander Hamilton argued for a long term of office. He said, if a president served only a year or two, America soon would have many former presidents. These former presidents, he said, would fight for power, and that would be bad for the peace of the nation. Benjamin Franklin argued for the right of re-election. The people, he said, were the rulers of a republic, and presidents were the servants of the people. If the people wanted to elect the same president again and again, they had the right to do this. In the final document, the president's term was set at 4 years, with re-election permitted. Next came the question of how to choose the president. It was a most difficult problem. The delegates debated and voted, and then re-debated and re-voted on a number of proposals. James Wilson proposed that the executive be elected by special representatives of the people called electors. Several delegates disagreed. They said the plan would be too difficult to carry out and would cost too much money. One delegate proposed that the president be elected by the state governors. He said the governors of large states would have more votes than the governors of small states. Nobody liked this proposal, especially delegates from the small states. Another proposal was to have the president elected directly by the people. Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts was shocked by this idea. "The people do not understand these things," he said. "A few dishonest men can easily fool the people." The worst way to choose a president, he said, would be to have him elected by the people. The convention voted on the issue 60 times. In the end, the delegates agreed that the president should be chosen by electors named by state legislatures. Now someone said, "We have decided how to choose the president, but what are we to do if he does bad things after being chosen? We should have some way of dismissing that person." Yes, the delegates agreed, it should be possible to try the president, and if he is found guilty, remove him from office. Governor Morris of Pennsylvania spoke in support of the right of impeachment should the president be persuaded to betray his trust. The delegates approved a proposal for removing a president found guilty of bribery, treason, or other high crimes. The last major question about executive authority was the question of veto power over the national legislature. Not one delegate was willing to give the president complete power to reject new laws, and yet they felt he should have some voice in the lawmaking process. If this were not done, they said, the office of president would have little meaning, and the national legislature would have the power of a dictator. James Madison offered a solution. "The president should have the power to veto a law," Madison said, "but his veto could be overturned if most of the members of the legislature voted to pass the law again." The final convention document listed more details about the office. For example, it said the president had to be a natural-born citizen of the United States or a citizen at the time the Constitution was adopted. The president must have lived in the United States for at least 14 years and be at least 35 years old. The executive would be paid, but the pay could not be increased or reduced during the term in office. The president would be commander-in-chief of the armed forces and, from time to time, report to the legislature on the state of the union. The final document also gave the words by which a president would be sworn in. Every 4 years, for more than 200 years now, each president has repeated this oath of office. "I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of the President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States." Another major issue debated by the convention was a national judiciary, a federal system of courts and judges. The delegates knew a lot about the issue. 34 of them were lawyers. 8 were judges in their home states. One question hung heavy in the air. The states had their own courts and judges. Did the national government need its own system too? Several delegates said no. Roger Sherman of Connecticut said existing state courts were enough. Besides, he said, a system of national courts would be too costly. John Rutledge of South Carolina opposed a national system of lower courts, but he argued for a Supreme Court. Eventually, the convention voted for both. There would be a Supreme Court and a system of lower courts. These courts would hear cases involving national laws, the rights of American citizens, and wrongdoing by foreign citizens in the United States. State courts would continue to hear cases involving state laws. The next question concerned the appointment of national judges. Some delegates believed judges should be appointed by the legislature. Others believed they should be appointed by the president. James Wilson argued in support of having one person appoint judges. He said experience showed that large bodies could not make appointments fairly or openly. John Rutledge disagreed strongly. By no means, he said, should the president appoint judges. He said that method looked too much like monarchy. Benjamin Franklin then told a funny little story. In Scotland, he said, he understood that judges were appointed by lawyers. They always chose the very best lawyer to be a judge. Then they divided that person's cases among themselves. The delegates voted on the issue. They agreed that the legislature could decide how many judges would sit on the Supreme Court. The president would appoint the judges. The legislature could establish lower courts from time to time. The president would appoint those judges too. The issues involving the executive and the federal courts were serious questions that most delegates felt strongly about. But the most hotly debated issue of the convention was still to come. Would small states and large states have an equal voice in the central government? That will be our story next week. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.